ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
67 years ago, many people thought that we were destined for super speed travel.
The possibility of leaving Adelaide, fulfilling a luncheon engagement in London, or attending the theatre or the opera, say, and being home again within 24 hours is no longer a fanciful dream.
But most of us still can't even get to work on time. So where did things go so wrong? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a special series about why we didn't end up in the future we were promised. It's available now on ABC Listen.
The Albanese government is selling off $3 billion worth of defence sites in a major overhaul of Australia's defence property portfolio. Defence Minister Richard Marles confirmed 64 defence properties, including islands, barracks and even golf courses, will be sold off entirely, while three will be partially divested as they're no longer fit for purpose. Now, the money-saving exercise comes as the Treasurer continues to deflect responsibility for Tuesday's interest rate hike and shows the government is aware of the challenges ahead. They're prickly ones. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Raf Epstein from ABC Radio in Melbourne.
You're always so proud of that. You're such a Melbourneite you are. Best place on earth.
Local radio.
Best place on earth.
Yes, it is the best place on earth.
Defence Minister Richard Marles has just announced this significant reform, otherwise known as a major sell-off of huge defence properties. Some of them are heritage listed. They're places we've looked at, I have certainly, and thought, God, what a beautiful piece of land. And now they're gone. Is just about money, Raf. Come on. It is, isn't it?
I think it is just about money, but I don't think they'll actually get much money out of it. Firstly, they are rockstar.
They're going to get a bit.
They are going to get a bit, but it takes time for the money to flow. Rockstar addresses, so Victoria Barracks, Paddington, amazing. The one in Melbourne, so many people. I got pictures this morning. People get their wedding pictures taken outside ivy-lined bluestone walls. They are delightful. I love the phrase from the reports. So they've been working on this a few years. Defence is constrained by the weight of its past. Urgent interventions are needed to correct this unsustainable trajectory. So they've had a whole lot of people look at these amazing properties. They're costing a fortune. There's a beautiful, actually, corrugated iron army barracks near me. So I live close to the Astor Theatre in Melbourne. So they're getting rid of some, you know, some amazing property. I don't think they're going to make that much money out of it. It takes a long time. They're heritage protected. Someone might buy it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it translates into the number one thing the government wants out of this, which I reckon is housing. The site in Maribyrnong in Bill Shorten's old seat is huge. They'll be able to put a lot of houses there, but it's not so simple. Something else on top of whether or not they make money and whether or not they get houses, this is a fight they're picking inside the defence community. Like, I got a text today on the show. Someone was listening to Marles and we were playing the Defence Minister's comments live, and he was saying he works at the Victoria Barracks in Melbourne. His name's Max from Glenferrie. What I'm really hearing is this belongs to the government. They're going to use it to pay their debts and fund new submarines at the expense of our defence workforce and in particular defence families who will now need to commute long distances. So it's like it sounds sensible, but it's not simple. And I think it has lots of traps and lots of pitfalls.
Yeah, I think it's so good to describe it that way, the traps and the pitfalls. So, you know, some context. There's been a lot of resistance inside the defence establishment to doing this. Some real legacy stuff, the heritage stuff, as you say, the workforce stuff. But the government has been pushing, and they finally landed this. They're really actually, you know, one person told me it's been a very difficult birth, right? Like, it has not been easy to get to this place. I do think it's ultimately about dealing with their debt problem and their subs problem, which is part of their debt problem, right? Because they've got to pay for these very, very expensive submarines and this expensive defence project. And also there's an ongoing demand on the budget from lots of different places, including increased spending on defence. And just because it's gone a bit quiet, the 3% of GDP argument, don't you think that's going to go forever, my friends? That will re-emerge its ugly head of demands on the government.
I've got a slightly different take to you. So you're right, money pressure, right? Think about how much money it is. Maybe it's $2 billion out of the three, once you account for all your costs. That is less than half of 1% of the annual defence budget. So I don't think it's the amount. It's much more, I think, an internal bureaucracy thing where if the Defence Department's asking for all this cash, every department has to be more efficient. Every department has to get rid of the things that are costing money for no use. So I think it's as much about those internal bureaucratic discussions in Canberra. But I just know from the feedback I get, the fight they're picking with the defence community, even though the one that they are keeping a naval training base at Pittwater in Sydney, which if you do die and go to heaven, I hope it looks like Pittwater in Sydney. I would love to, you know, end up in a place like that. But I think the major issue is it's kind of like cleaning up the back office so the front office at defence can start to really ask for the significant amounts of cash they want.
Yeah, the significant amounts of cash. Look, you mentioned the housing stuff, and I think that's important. The housing is a very big priority and should be, because that, like, if I talk to government people, and I do all the time, they tell me, you know, obviously they have this wicked inflation problem, which we're going to get to. They've got a lot of problems, a lot of things they're looking at, but they say housing and delivering on housing they see as pretty much one of their chief conundrums for this term, really trying to break the back of that problem. And so housing is big here, although Richard Miles did say not all will be prioritised for housing, right? So it's not only for housing, but I do think that is the biggest elephant.
How many press conferences is Richard Miles going to do at an old defence site where they're building housing? Gazillions, right? He's going to be doing those press conferences until he retires as defence minister, right? So it's important.
Yeah, it's very important. Okay, so I mentioned, as if it's just something to throw around like confetti, that it's just little inflation problem. It's not little.
No.
It's not little inflation problem, and I'll explain why. I know people have heard it all before, but, you know, a different sort of perspective on it. The reason it's not little, this inflation problem, is inflation is really a sort of economy-killing. I know I'm being a bit hyperbolic, but, you know, I'm trying to make the point that it's insidious, the impact it has on households, on businesses, on the way we run society, and has, let's never forget, I think it's always important, a disproportionate impact on lower-income people. It's stunning. Although right now, if you look at the figures we're talking about, interest rates go up. If you've got a $600,000 mortgage, you know, look at the housing prices in this country. That is now like really a stock standard thing. It's not a sort of the stuff of fiction anymore. That means $100 a month. It is serious stuff, right? So the government gets this hike, an increase in interest rates. It says it's not our fault. Look at the monetary statement. It's not our fault. It's not about the government spending. And it seems no one believes them.
Well, no, yet no one. I think the issue.
I said that to be provocative before you all write letters of complaint.
It's not about believing, and it goes to the government's credibility. Tom made a great point on yesterday's podcast. Firstly, that you can't take the credit for the fact that interest rates are coming down and then shirk the blame when interest rates go up. It highlights the very thing you're talking about, inflation, mortgage holders, people who look at the banking app before they go shopping. That's a huge cohort of Australians. They look at their bank balance before they walk into a supermarket. Interest rates and are a factor. Inflation is much, much more important for a huge segment of Australians. And in some ways, I think actually that the Reserve Bank Board's forecasts about the economy, wages are not going to keep up with prices. Growth is going to be smaller this year than it was last year. If you're already struggling to get the same basket of goods, to put the same things in your supermarket trolley, that's just going to get harder. So I think that's incredibly difficult. When you sort of said provocatively that no one believes them, I noticed Jim Chalmers said it to me when I had it on him on the radio. And I noticed actually with the transcript that he also said it with my ABC colleague, Steve Austin. He keeps quoting the Reserve Bank governor, because I was pointing out to him all of the bad things the Reserve Bank is saying about the economy. And he was quoting the governor saying, we're actually in a really good position. It's never a great place to be in the government if you need to point to something as, even though she's as eminent and serious and authoritative as the Reserve Bank governor, if you have to say, oh no, she says the economy's really good, that's a real struggle. And the something else I want to come back to when you say, does anybody believe them? You mentioned at the start of the week about Anthony Albanese being at the tennis on Friday night as a sign of him having his mojo back. This is the stuff people notice. We had a caller today, and a lot of Australians know when you watch Alcaraz serve from that Melbourne end, where the Melbourne thing is at Rod Laver Arena, the seats behind him, which is where the PM sits, you can't buy those seats. Everybody notices who is in those seats. Have a listen to what one of our callers said about the disconnect between the people who can go to those tennis matches and everybody else in the country.
I think Elbo was at the tennis on the Friday, which is great. And, yeah, and all the other corporates there. At their, I would suggest they probably didn't pay for the seats. And whereas if you and I were to pay, it would possibly be a couple of grand. And, yeah, but the corporates will be fine, Raf. So don't, yeah, nothing to see here. So all good.
Oh, Raf, you know, I'm not pretending I mix with very, you know, elitish people, yeah, because of my job. Like, I'm not trying to say I am, but, you know, like, obviously politicians are on my phone. Like, I get all of this world. But that world is not the world I grew up in, right? And I'm very aware that when you see those images, that world is a sort of fakeish version of life, and people feel really disgruntled about that disconnect. It's real, and it really demonstrates it through that, you know, that caller, and I think that's a real sentiment. Also, you know, it's obvious in the parking of people's vote, and I call it parking because no one's voting in an election right now with groups like One Nation. Like, people are pissed off. They're pissed off. And so, you know, your fancy pants Melbourne end is a demonstration of that. And I think that we're in this kind of moment now where the government is pulling out all the lines, right? It's not us, quoting the Reserve Bank governor, as you say, that Jim Chalmers does. All of this is part of the sort of stock standard lines. But something is changing, which is worth talking about, and that's they're opening the door to some bigger reform again in the wake of it.
Just before we get to the reform, the other difficulty with the conversation, so I could hear you and Jacob and you and Tom talking about, yeah, essentially economic credentials, right? The government's trying to burnish their economic credentials. Susan Lee's trying to build some economic credentials. My strong feeling is that even 5 or 10 years ago, how a political party responded to an interest rate rise was really important. It's not as though people are noticing everything you're saying in that week, but it's how you build your economic credibility. It's how you fatten the pig before market day, right? The market day being the election. Politics, I feel now, is changing. Anthony Albanese at the tennis, anybody at the tennis, issues around immigration, the sorts of things that One Nation talk about, they have a lot more traction. They have a lot more cut through in the media and then through to social media than anything Jim Chalmers says to me or to you or to anybody else. So those old-fashioned conversations, they only cost you. They don't actually give you much potential to build your political capital. So I think that's important to think about. You and I grew up in an era where winning that economic debate in the chamber might have been important. It's much less important. So then to talk about what you wanted you through to, which was economic reform, some big idea. We're heading into the second year of the second term of the Albanese government.
Well, the government has not ruled out things in terms of, you know, property taxes, which are obviously the perennial issue. Everyone bangs on about them. You know, will you change them? They shut the door at the last election, particularly on what, negative gearing reform, because they just wanted to shut down any opening from the coalition for any scare campaign. And now they're not doing the same sort of shutting, Raf. Now this gives the Treasurer some openings.
Yes.
He's got to do some big changes to tackle inflation, but to deal with the productivity issue. They had the big productivity summit, and it's all gone a bit quiet on the productivity front, hasn't it?
It has gone quiet on the productivity front. When you talk about the big reforms, so firstly, I've got no idea what a government could do to improve productivity. Mm. One thing I was really conscious of with the Treasurer this morning, he's the one who brought up his interview with Joseph Stiglitz. That is Treasurer code for, I am bringing up the interview where I left open the gate for a change on property taxes, in this instance on the capital gains tax. I thought that was interesting that he brought that up in and of himself. He's quite sensitive to the criticism that he might have been hiding and, you know, in some way he didn't do a press conference yesterday. That's that in some way that's him sort of trying to avoid responsibility. He's very willing to tell you all of the different interviews he's done, including having a chat with me. That push
loves a list.
He loves a list. But that push for reform, I actually got this devastating text from one of my listeners when I was talking to him saying, ask him if the PM is stopping him from doing what he wants to do. We all know that tension is real. I don't think it's bitter, but the tension is a real tension. There's a genuine sense in that party room of all those, the very big party room, they would love to change the capital gains tax when it comes to, you know, investors who invest in property. Can they? Will they? I think the one of the only ways they can cut through the chaos that's in the coalition and the poll rise that Pauline Hanson is generating is a big economic idea, but it's risky. You know, the whole thing about being bold, it has big rewards, but it also has big risks. What do you think they're actually going to do, PK?
I don't know what they're going to do. It's too early. But I know what's on the table because he's kind of told us and we know what's obvious, so we don't have to sort of stab in the dark.
I mean, but will they do it?
A manifesto. Well, if you are to predict that, you're an idiot. I'll tell you why.
Yes.
Because they've been nearly about to do
That's
things
true.
And then you're right.
No
the
decision.
PM said no. Politically, I don't think. Now, the PM's got, you know, he prides himself on how well he reads politics. He did win 94 seats. He's not afraid to remind people because he uses that as an example of, you know, like, trust me. I know how to be the smart centrist here, how to
yes.
sort of ride this wave, right? So while politics is getting more polarised and more extreme, the PM has always been the sort of middleman saying Australia's about middle politics. And when you're about middle politics, you don't want to mess with anything that could be seen as too extreme. Now, I personally, you know, and I do a bit of personal here. Like, I don't think big property reform is wacky and crazy. I think some of it is very logical, and great think tanks like the Grattan Institute have suggested some. It's not, I don't think it's wild, you know, left-wing socialist stuff, but the campaign in a world where people live in algorithms would be ugly, and the PM is alert to that, right? So I wouldn't predict what they're going to do because I can see them being nearly about to do something and him saying, as he watches a campaign being run by, you know, the usual suspects, thinking, nah, not worth it. However, I do think people, you know, like the Treasurer, like Andrew Charlton, who's sort of helping him out, and others will be pushing pretty hard for some big changes because they think it's time.
Yes.
And so it's if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in this May budget. That's what I think. So watch that space. But yes, the PM is very alert and alarmed about potential pitfalls of big changes. But they also know they can't look like a do-nothing government and they might end up looking like one. You can't just coast around. You got to do some big stuff. You've got to look like you're willing to take risks. And they have not been willing to take a lot of risks up to this stage. Raph.
Yes.
Can I dramatically segue into the coalition?
Please.
The coalition. What a time.
What a time to be alive.
They're not a coalition. No. So why did I call them the coalition? Well, I'll tell you why, because for a lot of time, they've been the coalition. So they're not the coalition. They're the Liberal and the National parties. I've been trying to talk about reuniting. As the days roll on, looks to me like it's harder and harder, Raph. I see you writing down some notes.
Yes.
What are you writing?
Firstly, there's nothing wrong
Get
with...
Get milk later.
No, no.
Your wife's just texted you.
No, no. I want to steal a line from Prince. Maybe we can call them the political group formerly known as the Coalition.
Yes, that's good.
Also, you were talking about Labor taking risks. The conversation is so heated. No one's in control of it. I don't even know where most people get their news if they're even looking for political news.
Mm.
Here's where risks might pay off for Labor. The significant problem remains for the Coalition, right? They don't have a strategy. Because they don't have a philosophy. It hasn't changed for a long time. It's difficult for them to strategize because they're not sure what they stand for. I think that still stems from something that started in the last decade. The divisions in our society don't divide Labor from Liberal, right? The biggest divisions in our society go right through the Liberal Party room and they divide the Libs from the Nats or they divide the Liberals from themselves. That's why they got into trouble with Bondi. Anybody with a passing knowledge of the issues that the Jewish community have been keen on would know the Liberal Party were going to have a problem once Parliament returned. It is a structural problem. If they don't know what they stand for, or if they don't know what they do stand for, they don't know what to do next. When your opponent is that confused, And it is the same on the right in Britain. It's different for Trump, different electoral system. That seems, in a political textbook way, like the perfect time to strike and the perfect time to take risks. This is a risk-averse government. They don't want to look like they're more interested in power than policy. They risk looking like they are more interested in power than in policy, despite the laundry list of things they will say that they have done. I think you're right that the May budget, it's very clear the coalition's in a phase of redefining themselves. The May budget, second year of a second term government, usually when you do the bold stuff, he did the voice in the first term, didn't work out the way he wanted it. You'd expect a bold idea to come in the May budget. You'd start baking that into the way the budget looks ahead for 4 years. I'm excited. It's actually an amazing year. We've got the South Australian state election. We've got a state election down here in Victoria. These tectonic plates that are shifting beneath the right, the left haven't responded yet. Not really. They keep winning elections and the Liberal Party are, you know, don't exist.
Well, there is a very hard difference between the centre-left and the harder left. That's the difference. But let's do a whole pot on that.
Yeah, sure. Sorry. I'm at that point. Yes, I'm going off into
other
places.
Don't say sorry, because it's really fascinating to explore the left. Not enough has been talked about. Before I go, though, we had the announcement of, we're going back to the right now, of former rogue Liberal senator turned crossbencher Corey Bernardi joining One Nation, leading the minor party at the South Australian election yesterday. And that, we're going to see March, the results, the first sort of live test of how One Nation's going after all the polling. This morning, recent defector Barnaby Joyce was talking about the legitimacy he's lent to One Nation. And, you know, okay, I hear you've got a bit of a Barnaby Joyce yarn, don't we all?
Three, or just a bit over 3 hour drive from Melbourne, is the glorious town, don't know, Horsham. Either way, lovely place. Population, 20,000 people. The Horsham Golf Club, I've not been to. I've been to Horsham. I haven't been to the Horsham Golf Club. On Sunday night, the Across Victoria Alliance, which are basically a bunch of pissed off farmers and volunteer firefighters who are very angry with the state Labor government, the keynote speaker at the Horsham Golf Club, kicking off the Across Victoria Alliance's big conference, is Barnaby Joyce. He is leading the One Nation charge for the Victorian election by addressing the alliance at the Horsham Golf Club. Here's where it's instructive and where it speaks directly to what's going on in Canberra. The new Liberal leader here in Victoria, Jess Wilson, she was going to go to that. She was going to address them. She was going to talk to them. The state Labor government were browbeating her about that, saying she's, you know, cozying up to One Nation. Jess Wilson pulled out, supposedly because of a diary rescheduling. Personally, I'd love to go and watch Barnaby Joyce speak at the Horsham Golf Club. I think it'd be pretty interesting, but this stuff is real. It is happening in real time. It's challenging the right. They are sending the Nationals leader, Danny O'Brien, here in Victoria, but Barnaby Joyce, Horsham Golf Club, Sunday night. It'll be interesting. Like, will it work, right? Will it work? One Nation have tried before in Victoria. Will it work?
Yeah. And bit of mail here. How will it influence? It's all about, watch this space. If you look at that by-election in Werribee, and that third-party vote, that was not under Jess Wilson as opposition, new Victorian opposition leader. She's a more sort of moderate Liberal. But when that happened, there was a big spraying, remember, of the vote to third parties. So will in the November election it go to One Nation? That will be key. I think it will a bit. I think it's unlikely it won't. I think there is a real thing there. So then what deals are done between One Nation and the Liberals? It might happen. And will the One Nation vote help the Liberals get across the line? Because there's a lot of seats for them to win, isn't there? It's a really hard, you know, yes, people are sick of the Labor government in Victoria and people might get angry to hear that, but it's a fact. They are on the nose. It's an old government. So she's got the chance, but that's a lot of seats to win.
So I don't want to get too stuck in Victorian politics, but the instructive example from the Werribee by-election and from actually previous state elections is when the votes spray to the right, to parties that are to the right of the Liberals and the Nats, they don't all come back to the Libs and the Nats in preferences. Some of those votes end up coming back to Labor. The Labor Party suffered a huge loss of their primary vote in Werribee to a significant independent from the community. They still held on to the seat. The centre-right didn't pick up those votes. So if that's where we're at for the coalition, they're in trouble. They need to change that dynamic in Victoria and South Australia, and they need to change it in a few years' time federally as well.
Well, that's it for politics now today. But Raf, I'm sorry to make you wait. You get up very early. I made you wait because I interviewed Clive Palmer. It will be on Afternoon Briefing, 4 o'clock on the ABC News Channel. Worth watching. He's contesting in the High Court the new electoral reform laws.
No stranger to courtrooms, Clive Palmer.
And tomorrow, David Spears will join Fran and I for the party room. And we love answering your questions. You can send them to theparty room@abc.net.au. Raf, you're an absolute legend. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, PK. Always a joy. Speak soon.